originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who tucked Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he's been one of the top riders on the Mid-Atlantic circuit, winning leading rider titles at Atlantic City and then for many consecutive years at Parks, also Los Alamitos. He won the Avelino Gomez Memorial Award and the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award. He won America's Hearts in 2004 with his Triple Crown bid with Smarty Jones, becoming the first jockey in 25 years to win the Kentucky Derby in his very first appearance. He's back riding in Kentucky now with 4,852 wins and over $102 million in earnings. It's an absolute pleasure to introduce jockey Stuart Elliott. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Stuart, we rode together for a number of years at Parks in that Mid-Atlantic region, and I've always been such a huge fan of yours, and I'm getting ready to tell you a little secret. When I was, 14 or 15 maybe in 2004 when you won the Derby and the Preakness with Smarty Jones, I wrote a fan letter to you. I don't know if you ever got it, but I was a fangirl. I sent you a letter and telling you all about just how much I looked up to you and how I wanted to be a jockey, and then lo and behold, we rode together. So can't thank you enough.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, can't thank you enough for doing this show today, Stewie. Been dying to get you on. How do you like Kentucky?
Oh, I love Kentucky. Yeah, I'm glad to be back in Kentucky.
Yeah, you've been here before. You've spent time here before. What made you decide to come back?
Well, we actually have a home here in Kentucky. And we bought the house. We bought the house just prior from me leaving for California for 3 years. The last 3 years I was in California, so we didn't spend a lot of time at the house. And so it kind of feels good to get back, you know, to get back here and to be able to go home, your actual home sometimes. Yeah, and the racing is good, and we just always like Kentucky. You know, my wife is actually is from here, family's from here, and it's just good to be back here. We love it here.
Tell us a little bit about your wife and your family.
Well, my son just turned 13, and he wants to be a jockey, but right now he's going to school and he goes fishing with me, and he kind of likes to be back here too, because in California it was all school mostly. We really didn't get to do much fishing or anything like that. So He's glad to be back. And my wife, she's glad to be back here. She's from Venezuela. And her family came from Venezuela to Kentucky. So now she gets to see, you know, her mom and her sisters are here. So it's good for everybody.
What do you think about your son wanting to be a jockey?
I don't know. I guess if that's what he wants, it's okay. I mean, I'm not going to... If he wants it, it's okay. I kind of have... there's good and bad thoughts about it. I mean, it can be a hard life. We all know that. You know, it's an up-and-down business. There's no guarantees. It's a gamble, really. But then there can be a lot of success, too. You know, there's ups and downs to it. So, and he's small, so there's probably a good chance that if that's what he wants to do, he'll be able to do it. But he's a kid, and he always changes his mind like a lot of kids. Like, he was into basketball, and he wanted to be a basketball player. I says, well, I don't think you have very much chance of that happening because I don't think you're going to be tall enough. And now when we go fishing, he's really into the fishing. So now he'll say, well, maybe I should be a bass pro, you know. So I said, hey, if that's what you want, you know, you can do whatever you want to do if you work hard at it. And, you know, so... But if he wants it, that's fine. And if he wants something else, that's fine, too.
Well, you yourself know what it's like growing up with your father riding races. Your dad was a jockey as well, and you actually were born in Canada, and you traveled around a lot with your family. Tell us what it was like growing up in a racing family.
Well, I was born in Toronto, Canada. And we moved around a lot. A lot of it I don't remember really in the beginning because I was young. Like, we were in Florida. I really don't remember much of that. We moved around. We were in the States. We were in Canada. But then when I was 7, we went to Hong Kong. And we were 6 years in Hong Kong. I remember all of that. That was different, you know. It was good, though. But I remember my father, and the reason he went to Hong Kong was because the weights were heavier. He was going to have to retire if he stayed in the United States or Canada because he couldn't make the weight anymore. He was having too much problems reducing. So his brother, my uncle, was out in Hong Kong when my father decided that he couldn't do it anymore. He was going to go to training, and my uncle got him the job to go over to Hong Kong and ride. And so it was different. And then after the 6 years in Hong Kong, we came back to the States, and my father retired and he started training horses. But I remember when he was riding, it was, you know, there was a lot of hard times before we got to Hong Kong. It was a lot of good, a lot of bad. You know how it is, up and down. When we got to Hong Kong, it was better because, he was on salary and he did pretty good out there. And in Hong Kong, it seems like, you know, it's kind of like there's no middle class really in Hong Kong either. Either the people are poor or they're pretty well off. And, you know, he was riding for a big trainer from Australia, and things were pretty good out there. But anyway, I remember that, you know, growing up before we went to Hong Kong, there was always a lot of moving around. And my father was away a lot, too. Sometimes he'd go to a meet and he wouldn't be home, you know, for a couple months, whatever. But anyway... you know, it's not an easy life.
So through the eyes of, you were what, 6 years old in Hong Kong when you first arrived?
From 7 years old.
Seven. So through the eyes of a seven-year-old, what was that Hong Kong experience like for you? And do you have any desire to ride overseas yourself?
Actually, I was invited in Hong Kong. I think it was in, 2006, somewhere around there. They had the Jockeys Challenge out there. And so I went over there to ride, and just for the one day, the one night, one or two nights. I think we were there for two nights, but we only raced the one night. And it was neat to see it again after so many years. I brought back a lot of memories, you know, after being there as a kid, and then 20 years later, whatever, go back and ride there. Okay, so that was pretty neat. But yeah, it was different. It was a different experience than most kids get to see. So, but I was pretty fortunate. I look at it that way. I mean, I got to see, you know, a different side of the world. You know, we were also like, he rode in India for a couple of weeks. I was over there. We lived over there, maybe a month. We were over there. So I got to see the world a little bit.
What a great experience. How's racing different in Hong Kong versus the U.S.?
From what I know, really, just from my experience being there and from what I'm told from my father and that, they're pretty strict over there. I know that as far as on the riders and that. And it's a little bit different, like the way they, like over here, our horses are, you know, they run for claiming prices, allowance and claiming prices and your stakes and that, of course. But over there, it's like it was at that time anyway, it was class. So they'd have class one, class two, class three, and a horse would have to, you know, if he competed in a certain class and couldn't do well, like hit the board or whatever, after like three or four starts, he would go into a different class. But that's really all I really know about it, actually, honestly. I don't really know a whole lot about it over there, you know?
Jockey Stuart Elliott joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Stewie, watching your father struggle with his weight for years and dealing with the ups and downs, that did not deter you from riding. You still wanted to ride yourself. And tell us how you got started.
Well, I didn't like school.
Good reason, right?
That's true, but I was always around the horses. Like, when we came back from Hong Kong, you know, now I'm 12, 13, and my father started training horses, and my mother, they had bought a farm, like 25 acres in Jersey, and my mother started giving riding lessons. And, you know, so I was always around the horses. And we would go to horse shows on the weekend. We had quarter horses. And the horse dealer that my mom and dad would buy their riding horses from, their quarter horses, we became really friends with them. And we'd go to the horse shows together. And actually, the man's name was Bud Locke. He would go out to the Midwest in the summer and buy his horses out there. He'd go to a lot of the quarter horse auctions and this and that. And a couple summers I would go with him. And I used to work the auctions for him. And you know, so I was always around the horses. So I learned, you know, I learned to ride. And then I was at the horse show and the quarter horses and all that. And then I would go to the racetrack as well and started off, you know, walking the horses, mucking stalls, and then eventually started galloping the thoroughbreds. so, you know, I was small, and on the racetrack, when I remember when I was 15, 16, I would get on some horses from my father, and I started making that they would pay. He would never pay me, but I started getting on horses for other people around the track. At that time, they were getting like $7 to gallop a horse, $8 to gallop a horse. So, I thought it was great. You know, I could go get on four or five horses and make make $50 for the day or something. And, you know, I'm staying at home. I have no bills. I'm, you know, 15. So it was something that I liked, and it was an easy way to make money. So I didn't like school. So as soon as I was 16, I wanted to ride. And my father, you know, he got too big. He struggled with his weight all his career. So we didn't know how big I was going to get. So, you know, I would tell my mom and dad, you know, I want to ride, and maybe I'm only going to have a couple years to ride. I might get too big. And if I get too big after a couple years, I can always go back to school, whatever. But they were willing to let me ride. They wanted to see me ride too, I think, you know. So that's how it went.
Well, you rode your very first race in 1981. I guess it was Keystone Racetrack back then.
Yes.
You remember that first race, Stewie?
I remember. It was for a trainer that was friends with my father, Ralph Kistner, I think his name was. But anyway, I remember it, and I remember, you know, going on the post raid, warming up, and everybody told me to don't forget to put your goggles down. And it was pretty cool, but yeah, I remember it.
Did business take off then, or did you just kind of ease into it?
Kind of eased into it. Like I was, you know, I was a young 16. I mean, I was kind of still hadn't come out of my shell. You know, I was kind of shy still, and I didn't really know how to talk to people really good. And my parents knew this, so we figured they'd just ride, and your bug doesn't start, you know, of course, till you ride so many winners. So we just figured we'd take our time. But things did get going a little bit quicker than we thought. But it gave me a chance to start meeting new people and get used to talking to people and, you know, get off the farm, kind of start going out and being in the real world. And got an agent. And by the time I think we went to, I started like in January. And then in the spring, we went to Atlantic City. And I had a great meet. I ended up leading rider there. So things got going pretty good.
Well, and isn't it funny? I believe Service was an agent at Atlantic City, and that's really where you two, I guess, first met.
Yeah. Yeah, John Service was an agent, and he had a bug boy, Shannon Sullivan. And he was one of, there was another bug boy too, Nick Valentino, I think. And the three of us were the three bug boys. So we were all each other's competition, you know. So John Service was was an agent, and he was my competition.
Well, and you beat him out for the leading rider title, so.
Yeah, yeah.
He paid attention to you. Well, and then Stuart, you actually... you had a bit of an accident that I guess you had a horse flip and hurt your back, and then I guess you had to take some time off. You got big again. I guess you gained some weight. Tell us that story.
Wow, you know, a lot of people don't know about that, the back one. That was when I went to, that was years later, a few years later when I went to, well, I actually, what happened was I had the bug in Atlantic City. I was there until 83. I had lost the bug, and I was still doing okay. I had one big outfit that was that I was riding for. Jeff Kirk was the trainer. He was training for Scarlett Farms, I think it was, yeah. But anyway, he was keeping me going. I was doing pretty good, but you know how you have to make that transition when you first lose the bug. Sometimes, you know, it gets tough. And,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing okay, but my uncle called me. My uncle was training up in Woodbine, Canada, and they were closed. They don't run in the wintertime, so he called me and he said, how would you like to come to Boston for the winter? He says, I'm going to bring 20 head or 15 head, whatever it was, he says. And then if you see how things go there, and if you want to come back to Woodbine with me in the spring. So I said, sure, let's go give it a shot. I can always come back to Philly. You know, my mom and dad had horses there. They were training there. And I, you know, I knew everybody and had done well with the bug bats and that. So anyway, I go to New England, and things go good in New England. I end up staying there. But a few years after being in New England, my mom and dad actually brought their horses to New England. They were training in New England now, too. They followed me. But one of my father's owners had most of his horses in Florida. So they wanted me to go down there to ride a stake. They said, we're going to put two or three in. Would you come ride the stake? So I said, sure. So anyway, I go down there. I ride the stake. I ride the horses. I think they were second and third. They all ran good, but none of them won, but they ran good. So now I get back to New England, and about a week goes by, and they call me back, and they say, how would you like to come to Florida? You know, there's a trainer. You know, he's got all the horses, the same owner did. So I said, okay. So now I end up in Florida. I get to Florida, and I'm rolling. Things are going good because, you know, I'm running into people that I knew from Atlantic City and this and that. But I had a two-year-old that, and I was reducing. I was getting a little bit, you know, I wasn't 102 pounds anymore. And I wasn't going about it the right way. You know, instead of getting on a diet, I was doing all the wrong things. I was reducing and kind of struggling with my weight, making the weight, but, you know, having to work pretty hard at it. So anyway, now I get hurt. A horse, it was a two-year-old going to the gate, kind of pulled away from the pony and flipped over. But when it flipped over, it went over the fence, the outside fence. And I kind of come down on my back, and I hurt my back. So instead of paying rent in Florida, now I'm laid up. I go back home to New England. I had a house up there. But now I'm heavy. I'm, you know, without working and just from having the time off, I get pretty heavy. So I just galloped horses for, took me about a year I took off, and then I got back riding again.
I can't imagine that, talking about the ups and downs. Well, there you go. You were doing so well, and then I can't imagine the, you know, what you're thinking in your mind. You want to ride so bad, and then you're gaining weight, and obviously that's just such a struggle with so many riders, including myself. I know what that's like. So was there any doubt in your mind that you would come back at that point?
I was pretty sure I could come back, and I think what a big part of it was, and this happens to a lot of riders, I'm sure, you know, it's starting as a rider, you know, 16 years old, 102 pounds, I'm eating whatever I want, you know, like I had done all my life, you know. I didn't have to have no discipline for my weight. And then things started to change. You know, I started getting where, man, I got to get in the box. So that's what I would do. But instead of getting on a diet or going to see a nutritionist or just doing things the right way, you know, I would take Lasix. I started taking Lasix, and I was to the point where, you know, I would take one pill, And then a month later, now I'm taking two, now I'm taking three, now I'm taking four, and then I'm cramping up, I'm getting cramps, I'm reducing, I started flipping and doing all the wrong things. And that becomes a job in itself, you know, trying to keep your weight. So I think that when I got hurt, it was kind of a relief. Like, oh, man, I don't have to pull 5 pounds tomorrow, you know? And my body blew up. I think my body sucked up all the weight. And I got up to about 133 pounds. But after, you know, after some time off, my body, I probably stayed at about 127 pounds. But I think, you know, that was doing it all the wrong way. So when I decided I wanted to come back, I started jogging, I started watching my weight, I started eating right, salads and doing things the right way. And I was able to come back and do it where in a better way, where it wasn't such a struggle with the weight.
How old are you now, Stuart?
I just turned 54.
54. So you've learned how to maintain that. That's the biggest difficulty in my mind is maintaining that weight, getting on that good regimen. Are you still able to maintain it well, and how do you do that?
Yeah. And, you know, there's been times like through my career, like I've gone through stages anyway where, you know, man, you might have 6 months where, man, I'm having trouble, and I got to hit the box a little bit, you know, or I got to jog a little bit. I got to work at it. But and then there's been times where, you know, like now, I'm good. As long as I just kind of have my routine. I get up in the morning. I'll have a little bit of, like, I'll have, like, a nutrition bar with my vitamins, coffee. And then I have a dinner at night, and I'm good. I stay at about 113. And so far, you know, that's the way it's staying.
Well, folks, we will continue our visit with Joggy Stuart Elliott right after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
They head for home. Lionheart set down to a full-out drive. The outside, here comes Smarty Jones. Smarty Jones, Lionheart digs in gamely. Smarty Jones pushing on by. Smarty Jones is taking the lead. Lionheart tough as nails. Smarty Jones is going clear. The unbeaten colt, Smarty Jones, is drawing away to win the Derby. Smarty Jones and Stewie Elliott going on to win. Smarty Jones goes on to win the Kentucky Derby, and that big bonus by 2.5. Lionheart ran second, and finishing third was Imperialism, then Limehouse.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined this evening by jockey Stuart Elliott. Stuart, we just heard the replay of your Kentucky Derby victory in 2004 with Smarty Jones. Your first ever appearance in the Kentucky Derby. And you're getting there on this unbeaten colt, Smarty Jones. Kind of a big deal. And let's talk a minute now about Smarty Jones and your campaign together. And how did you first get connected?
Well, I always rode some horses for John Service. I would work a lot of horses in the morning for John and rode a lot for him. But I remember this winter day at Philadelphia Park. I was on this horse, Smarty Jones, for John in a maiden special weight. I think it was like the last or next to last race that day, and it was a miserable, cold, kind of rainy, sleeting day, whatever. And I knew nothing about the horse. You know, it was one of them horses that I just had never been on, never worked, had no clue about him. So I go to the paddock, and John says, you know, and it's just kind of one of them days that, you know, it's the end of the card. You have probably already rode four or five, and it's going to snow, you know. You just want to get out of there and go home. So he says, just watch him in the gate. He says he's been bad in the gate. And we had, I think he was either number one or number two, and it was like a 11 or 12 horse field. So he says, just watch him in the gate. And that was pretty much all he told me about him. So we go to the gate, and he's kind of hesitant to get in the gate, but he gets in there, and he's good. And the gate's open, and I'm in front flying, and I'm trying to slow him down, and he feels to me like he's running off, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going too fast. There's no way this horse can go 3/4 of a mile like this, which is what the race was. So I said, he's going to hit the quarter pole like a wall, you know. But anyway, he wins. And he wins. And he runs pretty fast, pretty good time, I guess. So I get back to the winner's circle, and John's there, and there must be like 40 people come out of the woodwork. Like, I don't know where all these people at. So I says to John, I says, where have you been hiding this one at? And he's laughing. So that was Smarty Jones for the first time. I knew nothing about him. And the whole thing was, you know, can we get him to relax and will he stretch out was the whole question. We knew he could run, but we didn't know if he was just going to be a sprinter or if he would settle and be able to go on and do what he did, you know.
Obviously he did, Stewie, because after that maiden victory at Philly Park, which, by the way, you had to be a little surprised. Those kind of horses don't usually run at Philly Park. And I'm sure, yeah, you were surprised when he just went on with it. And you all won the Pennsylvania Nursery Stakes after that at Philly Park. Then the Count Fleet Stakes. Then you went to Oaklawn. And you cleaned up at Oaklawn. And tell us how the horse matured from that first time you sat on him until his first appearance at Oaklawn Park.
All right. Well, you know, we knew that we had a really fast horse, a really talented horse. But the whole thing was, you know, can we get him? We got to teach him to chill out a little bit, you know, to pace himself and this and that. So the next race was 7/8, which was perfect, you know, just a little bit further. So now that I knew the horse and this and how he was and this and that, you know, when he won the next time, it was kind of the same thing. You know, he was pretty aggressive. He come out of there, and he win. I think he broke the track record or equaled the track record that race. But then his third start was a flat mile in New York, and he was number 7 out of 7. So what that allowed me to do is when he broke, I just took a hold of him. I just got him and, you know, kind of was trying to teach him to rest. And a couple horses were in front of me, and he sat third, and he kind of got the idea. You know, he took him a little bit, but then he come back and he sat third and he went on and he won. And that was, you know, it was good the way things worked out, because his next race, I think, was a mile and a 16. And he got it. You know, as long as I grabbed him right away, he would just stay where he was. He wouldn't get too aggressive. He would always get on the bridle, but he really wouldn't get where he pulled too bad. He kind of got the idea a little bit, and he got better as he went, and he learned to rate, and you know, that's what made him be able, you know, to go on and win those better races. And then when he got to Oaklawn, you know, he was doing good, he won. And then I remember John telling me for the Southwest, which was his first race in Oaklawn, he told me, he said, he says, I don't have him 100% fit. He said, just keep that in mind. He might, if he's going to get beat, if he's going to lose, this will be the day he loses. And we just hung on. We win it by a neck. I think he won it. But he kind of run the same way. You know, he stalked right there, and he put away the two horses that were in front of him, and a closer, a horse of Steve Asmussen's, come rolling at us and almost got us, but we just held on. And then he needed that race. And then after he had that race underneath of him, he won the Rebel, and then the Arkansas Derby, and then went on and won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness.
Prior to shipping to Kentucky, Stuart, obviously everyone was wondering, would John keep you aboard? Or is he going to be loyal and you've been along for the journey? Or, as what happens a lot of the time, you see trainers and owners go for the regular Kentucky jocks, or the jocks who are always riding in those big races, the Kentucky Derby. But they were loyal and they stuck with you. And I read an article, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was here in Kentucky back in 2004. They said, Stu who? You quickly showed them who you were. And talk about the Chapmans a little bit and your relationship with them and why you think they decided to keep you on the horse.
Well, I think, you know, they were great, and I'm, you know, so thankful to this day that they gave me the opportunity to stick when we got to those, you know, bigger races. But I think, you know, from knowing John for many years, from Ryan, from having a good relationship with John and knowing him, you know, we knew each other pretty good, we'd worked with each other pretty good. And then the horse had won every time, you know. And I was the only one that had ridden the horse. You know, so I was the only one. And then I knew him. But, yeah, I think it was just, you know, from having a good relationship with John. And John, you know, I'm sure the owners maybe wanted to go another direction, but I think John kept me on, and I'm not sure. I know Mrs. and Mr. Chapman, they were always extremely happy too with things, but I'm just thankful that I appreciate that they let me ride that horse.
Going into the Derby, Stuart, obviously you drew to the far outside. I know he's number 15. I think you broke from the 13th hole, was it?
The 15.
Okay. So you broke from the 15 hole. So obviously that provides a lot of challenges in and of itself. Post position in the Derby is such a big thing. What was your game plan going into the race?
Well, he was always right in the game. If he wasn't in front, he could have been in front in probably all of his races, you know, especially early. But we had, you know, just kind of taken a hold of him. We got him to right. He was always laying third, second, third, fourth, you know. So looking at the Derby, I remember, you know, there were some speed horses in there. And, you know, the whole thing with a big field like that, the Derby, you know what a cavalry charge it is into the first turn. He always broke good. He always broke pretty good. So the whole plan was just to get out of the gate good and get a position. I mean, he needs to be right up there. You know, depending, you never know how this looked like. There could be a good pace, but even with that, he's one of them horses that he gets in the gate. That's his style. He runs right up there, and that's what we wanted to do. And you know, of course, it poured that day, and it was the first time that he was going to have mud. We didn't know how that was going to go, but everything went good.
Yeah, I'd say so. So I have to ask you, what was it like walking through the post parade and hearing My Old Kentucky Home? And that's the first time you've been in the Derby. What was that experience like?
It was pretty cool. I mean, that's something I think any rider, you remember that, you know. I think especially your first time, that's pretty special.
And then turning for home, you shot a good trip. You're able to save some ground. And turning for home, when was the point that you knew you had to race run? One.
Well, I'll tell you about the race. When he broke, you know, he broke good, but there was a cavalry charge. His Smarty Toes wasn't a really big horse. And we're running into that first turn, and he's in the middle of couple of big ones. they're squeezing him, and he stayed for me. He held his position for me going into the first turn. It was either stay in there. If he didn't stay in for me, he would have never won the race. But he stayed in, and when we got into the first turn, he was in great position. We got down on the inside, but he's eating a lot of mud. We get around the first turn. We're following Lionheart, and there's a couple horses outside of me. We get around the first turn, and then about the 5/8 pole, I'm right behind Lionheart, and there's a horse kind of on my outside kind of keeping me there. But that horse kind of faded back, and I remember about the 4.5, somewhere in there, when I was able to ease out of Lionheart's mud from behind him and get him clear. He got on the bit, and then I knew. I said, "There's my horse. I'm good." I said, "Now they're gonna have to, now if he don't win from here, it's just not his day, or he's not good enough." But then at that point, he got on the bridle, and he got like where I knew. I said, "Okay, they're gonna have me to beat now." And so I was pretty confident. Once we got around that first turn, he got in this clear sail and got in this, you know, where he was not, where he was comfortable. Of course, you never know. It's early in the race, but he made me feel pretty good about things right then.
He crossed the wire in front, Stuart, and as I mentioned during the introduction, your all's campaign for the Triple Crown was just amazing, stole America's hearts. And so then you go on to Pimlico. And you're undefeated going into Pimlico, into the Preakness. And who were you most worried about in the Preakness?
Probably Lionheart. Because Preakness, you know, is always kind of a speed favoring. Probably him, and he ran good. He was tough to beat that day.
Yeah, but then you all went on to win by over 11 lengths, and you had to be pretty confident also going into the race. You were back on your home turf. You'd ridden in Maryland before, versus Kentucky was a little bit of new territory at that point, but you were in familiar surroundings, so you had to feel good about that.
Yeah, and the way he had run in the Derby, and now going back to a fast track, a smaller field, was pretty confident about things.
And going into the Belmont, Stuart, I can't imagine the excitement, the pressure you had to feel, and just it all had to be so overwhelming. How did you take it all in?
It it was kind of like every race, you know, when you go to the Derby, say, you know, the build up, everybody, you know, that it's the big build up, and it's kind of like you just kind of want to put them in the gate and get it over with, and you just hope, like I said all along, you hope everything goes good. You hope that, you know, he doesn't stumble at the gate, or he doesn't not run this time, or he doesn't bleed, or he doesn't get boxed in, or something go wrong. You just hope that you have a good trip, and if you get beat fair and square, hey, at least you know you had no excuse. You just don't want anything to go wrong. But it was the same thing again. You know, now we had the Derby. Now we're waiting for the Preakness and all the build-up, all the publicity. And then you just kind of want to get it going. And then it was the same thing for the Belmont. Now he's, you know, can we win the Triple Crown? Can he go the mile and a half was the big question. Like I said, when he first run, it was, can we get him to go seven? Will he go a mile, you know? Now the big question was the mile and a half. But I just wanted to do it, let go. You know, it was the build-up and all the being so busy and the telephone calls and all the publicity. And it was great, and it got to sometimes where you just wanted to get it done.
What was the game plan going into the Belmont, going a mile and a half? You had to probably change your thinking just a little bit.
Yeah, you know, the deal was that he had to chill out and you know, just do what he's been doing. Just, you know, we got a long way to go, and just, you know, same thing. We ride him the same way. Just hopefully everything goes the same.
Take us through the race.
Well, he broke, and this time he was a little aggressive, and he kind of got into the first turn, and he never really came back to me this time, and I'm strangling him. I'm trying to get him to relax, and he's not, because usually when I would take a hold of him, early in the beginning when I run around, I'd take a pretty good hold of him, he would come back. Well, he wasn't coming back this time. He had a horse on his outside that he wouldn't relax. The horse was forcing me, and I actually tried dropping his head. I said, on the first turn, I said, this isn't going to work. We can't go a mile and a half like this. This will never work. I tried dropping his head and to see if that would work, and that didn't work either. But he just never settled enough to go the mile and a half, and I knew it, but he still almost won the race, believe it or not. But he just never, I knew on the first turn, I said, there's no way this is going to work over a mile and a half. He wasn't relaxed like he had been before.
Turning for home, Stuart, you let him out a little bit down on the backside. I always think, especially in the Belmont, speed is your advantage. And so you let him out a little bit, turning for home, starts to open up, and then at one point, did you realize Birdstone was coming?
About the eighth pole, I guess, somewhere around there. I could tell that he was closing, and we still had too far to go. I said, I can't. The wire is too far away. We're not going to make it. But he fought, and he hung in pretty good, considering everything, you know.
He really did. He dug in through it all, and I don't know the exact margin, but just got beat, literally, and had to be, I mean, it was over. You did it. You both were so successful, but obviously following that moment, crossing the wire second, had to be obviously disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know. But that's horse racing.
That is horse racing, Stuart. And remind me, I think, did he retire after that?
Yes. Yeah.
So we never got to see him again, but he's a a stallion. He's living the good life. So he has to be enjoying that. And do you ever go see him?
I went and saw him, but I haven't seen him in a long time now. Yeah, I haven't seen him in a long time.
Jockey Stuart Elliott joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Excuse me just a second. So, Stuart, following the defeat in the Belmont, did you go back home to Parks to ride for several years, I guess?
Yeah, I went back there, and stayed there for a while. And then the Monmouth, you know, ended up going to Monmouth and that, but right there.
What prompted you? Didn't you take a little bit of a break? Didn't you stay in Kentucky for a while?
Yeah, what I did was I'd go to Monmouth for the summer and then back to Parks and this and that. And the last couple winters in Parks was just, you know, we were getting bad storms, the weather, we were losing the racetrack. And I said, after the second year in a row like that, I said, man, this is brutal. The cold, the bitter cold, and then not being able to race. And then you'd lose your horses, too, because they'd go to New York and run, and you're supposed to run at Philly, and then you cancel at Philly. It was just a headache. So anyway, I had to go to Turfway to ride a stake for John's service, and I'm going into the jocks room, and I run into Nelson Arroyo, who we had ridden with. I don't know. I think he was there when you were there. I'm not sure, but I had ridden with him anyway at Parks. So he says to me, he says, hey, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. You know, we hadn't seen each other in a while. He says, yeah, I'm an agent now. I'm a jockey agent. He says, I'm doing good. He had the lean rider. He says, you know, you should seriously think about coming to Kentucky. He says, think it over. So I said, all right, you know, with the situation in Philadelphia, not in the wintertime. So anyway, I ride down, I go back, and he calls me maybe a week later or something, and he says, how would you like to come back and ride? I'm not sure I think I had to go back there for John again, and he wanted to know if I was coming back. And I said, yeah, I'm coming back. But he got me on a horse. He said, I'm going to try to get you on a couple horses now that I know you're coming. And he got me on a couple horses. One was for Mark Cassie, I think, in the Spiral Stakes. And the horse ran great, finished third, got beat like a half a length for the whole thing. But anyway, I decided to go to Kentucky. I could ride that horse back, and that's how I ended up going to Kentucky. Went to Kentucky, did great, rode for Mark Cassie in the spring meet, the Keeneland meet. We went to Keeneland, ended up second leading rider, then went to Churchill, and then in August went to California with Mark Cassie and Nelson. Was in California for 3 weeks, and I broke my ribs. So now I go back home to California, and I go back to Kentucky, and I start riding the fall meet at Keeneland, but I shouldn't have. My ribs weren't healed. I came back too early. And I never let myself heal. I was moving. We had actually sold the place in Jersey and moved to Kentucky. I was moving, lifting boxes and doing all that. So then I kind of got into another business. I took about a year off. Kind of got into another business, kind of got that going. And then wasn't even sure if I was going to come back and ride. Really, at one point, I said I wasn't going to come back and ride. Then I always thought about California. I said, man, what, things were going so good in California. Won a stake, had working horses for everybody, and got hurt. So after about a year being off, I went back to California. And then I was the last 3 years in California. Had bought the house here in Kentucky and had never been there. So now, things were good in California, but the fields were getting small. The cost of living is very high. And I said, I'm kind of just paying to be here. I said, I miss the house. So I went to Oakland, had a good meet in Oakland, and now that brings me back here, back home, and back to Kentucky. But yeah, that year off is what you were talking about.
Stuart, you've been all around the world, and now you're back here in Kentucky. So happy to have you here. We only have about a minute left. One quick question to go. You've seen it all. You've been through the ups and downs, the weight, even dealt with alcoholism, like so many jockeys that I know personally. What advice would you give to a young rider?
I would say just, stay away from the drugs, stay away from the alcohol, just kind of keep a level head. This is nothing lasts forever. And, take the good and the bad, take it on an even keel, work hard, save your money, because a lot of kids, like me, you think it's never going to end. Well, there's hard times somewhere along the line. It's going to be hard times. There's injuries. There's hard times, and nothing lasts forever. So save the money and just work hard and do the right thing. Don't go to bed. Don't get into the drugs and the alcohol. You have to feel good. Treat your body. You're an athlete. Do the right thing. Save your money and work hard.
Stuart, we are all out of time. Wishing you all the best. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. And thanks for listening.